Blackthorn was not perturbed. He knew that now Toranaga clearly understood that this possible tactic would certainly draw off a large proportion of Kiyama Onoshi Harima forces, all of whom were Kyushu-based. And Erasmus could certainly wreck any large-scale seaborne transfer of troops from that island to the main one. "Be patient," he cautioned himself. "Let Toranaga consider it. Maybe it'll be as Mariko says. There is a long time between now and Osaka, and who knows what might happen. Prepare for the best, but do not fear the worst. Anjin-san, why not say this in front of Mariko-san? She will tell priests. You think that?" "No, sire. Only want to try talk direct. Not woman's business to war." "One last ask, Toranaga-sama." Blackthorn launched himself on a chosen course. "Custom Atamoto ask favor, sometimes. Please excuse me, sire. May I respectfully say now possible ask?" Toranaga's fan stopped waving. "What favor?" "No divorce easy, if Lord say. Ask Toda Mariko-sama, wife." Toranaga was dumbstruck, and Blackthorn was afraid he'd gone too far. "Please excuse me for my rudeness," he added. Toranaga recovered quickly. "Mariko-san agrees?" "No, Toranaga-sama. Secret my. Never say to her, anyone. Secret my only. Not say to Toda Mariko-san. Never. Kinjuro, ne? But no angers between husband, wife. Divorce easy in Japan. This my secret only. Ask Lord Toranaga only. Very secret. Never Mariko-san. Please excuse me if I've offended you."
"That's a presumptuous request for a stranger. Unheard of. Because you're Hatamoto, I'm duty-bound to consider it, though you're forbidden to mention it to her under any circumstances, either to her or to her husband. Is that clear?"
"Please?" Blackthorn asked, not understanding at all, hardly able to think.
"Very bad ask and thought, Anjin-san. Understand?"
"Yes, sire. So sorry."
"Because Anjin-san Hatamoto, I'm not angry. We'll consider. Understand?"
"Yes, I think so. Thank you.
Please excuse my bad Japanese. So sorry."
"No talk to her, Anjin-san, about divorce. Mariko-san or Buntaro-san. Kinjiro, wagarimasu?"
"Yes, Lord. Understand. Only secret, you, I. Secret. Thank you. Please excuse my rudeness, and thank you for your patience."
Blackthorn bowed perfectly, and almost in a dream, he walked out. The door closed behind him. On the landing, everyone was watching him quizzically. He wanted to share his victory with Mariko, but he was inhibited by her distracted serenity and the presence of the guards.
"I'm sorry to keep you waiting," was all he said.
"It was my pleasure," she answered, as non-committal.
They started down the staircase again. Then, after a flight of stairs, she said,
"Your simple way of talking is strange, though quite understandable, Anjin-san."
"I was lost too many times. Knowing you were there helped me tremendously."
"I did nothing."
In the silence they walked on, Mariko behind him slightly, as was correct custom. At each level they passed through a samurai cordon. Then, rounding a bend in the stairs, the trailing hem of her kimono caught in the railings, and she stumbled. He caught her, steadying her, and the sudden close touch pleased both of them.
"Thank you,"
she said, flustered, as he put her down again. They continued on, much closer than they had been tonight. Outside, in the torchlit forecourt, samurai were everywhere. Once more, their passes were checked, and now they were escorted with their flare-carrying porters through the donjon main gate, along a passage that meandered maze-like between high, battlemented stone walls to the next gate that led to the moat and the innermost wooden bridge. In all, there were 7 rings of moats within the castle complex. Some were man-made, some adapted from the streams and rivers that abounded. While they headed for the main gate, the south gate, Mariko told him that when the fortress was completed the year after next, it would house 100,000 samurai and 20,000 horses, with all necessary provisions for 1 year.
"Then it will be the biggest in the world,"
Blackthorn said.
"That was Lord Torinaga's plan."
Her voice was grave.
"Shigata ganai, ne?"
At last they came to the final bridge.
"There, Anjin-san, you can see the castle's the hub of Edo, ne? The center of a web of streets that angle out to become the city. 10 years ago, there was only a little fishing village here. Now, who knows? 300,000? 2? 4? Lord Torinaga hasn't counted his people yet. But they're all here for one purpose only. To serve the castle that protects the port and the plains that feed the armies."
"Nothing else?" he asked.
"No."
"There's no need to be worried, Mariko, and look so solemn," he thought happily. "I've solved all that. Torinaga will grant all my requests."
At the far side of the flare-lit Ichibashi, first bridge, that led to the city proper, she stopped.
"I must leave you now, Anjin-san."
"When can I see you?"
"Tomorrow, at the hour of the goat. I'll wait in the forecourt for you."
"I can't see you tonight. If I'm back early?"
"No, so sorry. Please excuse me. Not tonight."
Then she bowed formally.
"Konbanwa, Anjin-san."
He bowed, as a samurai. He watched her going back across the bridge, some of the flare carriers going with her, insects milling the stationary flares that were stuck in holders on stanchions. Soon she was swallowed up by the crowds in the night. Then, his excitement increasing, he put his back to the castle and set off after the guide. Chapter 48.
"The barbarians live there, Anjin-san."
The samurai motioned ahead. Ill at ease, Blackthorn squinted into the darkness, the air breathless and sultry.
"Where? That house? There? Yes, that's right. So sorry. You see it?"
Another nest of hovels and alleys was 100 paces ahead, beyond this bare patch of marshy ground, and dominating them was a large house etched vaguely against the jet sky. Blackthorn looked around for a moment to get his approximate bearings, using his fan against the encroaching bugs. Very soon, once they had left First Bridge, he'd become lost in the maze. Their way had led through innumerable streets and alleys, initially toward the shore, skirting it eastward for a time, over bridges and lesser bridges, then northward again along the bank of another stream, which meandered through the outskirts, the land low-lying and moist. The farther from the castle, the meaner were the roads, the poorer the dwellings. The people were more obsequious, and fewer glimmers of light came from the shojis. Edo was a sprawling mass which seemed to him to be made up of hamlets separated merely by roads or streams. Here on the southeastern edge of the city, it was quite marshy, and the road oozed putridly. For some time, the stench had been thickening perceptibly, a miasma of seaweed and feces and mudflats, and overlying these, an acrid sweet smell he could not place, but that seemed familiar.
"Stinks like Billingsgate at low tide," he muttered,
killing another night pest that had landed on his cheek. His whole body was clammy with sweat. Then he heard the faintest snatch of a rollicking sea shanty in Dutch, and all discomfort was forgotten.
"Is that Vink?"
Elated, he hurried toward the sound, porters lighting his way carefully, samurai following. Now, nearer, he saw that the single-story building was part Japanese, part European. It was raised on pilings and surrounded by a high rickety bamboo fence in a plot of its own, and much newer than the hovels that clustered near. There was no gate in the fence, just a hole. The roof was thatch, the front door stout, the walls rough-boarded, and the windows covered with Dutch-style shutters. Here and there were flecks of light from the cracks. The singing and banter increased, but he could not recognize any voices yet. Flagstones led straight to the steps of the veranda through an unkempt garden.
A short flagpole was roped to the gateway. He stopped and stared up at it. A limp, makeshift Dutch flag hung there listlessly, and his pulse quickened at the sight of it. The front door was thrown open. A shaft of light spilled onto the veranda. Bacchus van Neck stumbled drunkenly to the edge, eyes half shut, pulled his codpiece aside, and urinated in a high, curving jet.
"Ah!" he murmured with a groaning ecstasy. "Nothing like a piss. Isn't there?"
Blacklund called out in Dutch from the gateway.
"Why don't you use a bucket?"
"Eh?"
Van Neck blinked myopically into the darkness at Blackthorn, who stood with the samurai under the flares.
"Jesus God in heaven, samurai!"
He gathered himself with a grunt and bowed awkwardly from the waist.
"Komen nasai, samurai-sama! Ichibangomen nasai to all monkey-samas!"
He straightened, forced a painful smile, and muttered half to himself,
"I'm drunker than I thought. Thought the bastard son of all spoke Dutch. Komen nasai, nay?"
He called out again, reeling off toward the back of the house, scratching and groping at the codpiece.
"Hey, Bacchus, don't you know better than to foul your own nest?"
"What?"
Van Neck jerked around and stared blindly toward the flares, desperately trying to see clearly.
"Pilot?"
he choked out.
"Is that you, pilot? God damn my eyes, I can't see. Pilot, for the love of God, is that you?"
Blackthorn laughed. His old friend looked so naked there, so foolish, his penis hanging out.
"Yes, it's me."
Then to the samurai who watched with thinly covered contempt.
"Mate kudasai.
Wait for me, please."
"Hai, Anjinsan."
Blackthorn came forward, and now in the shaft of light he could see the litter of garbage everywhere in the garden. Distastefully, he stepped out of the clogs and ran up the steps.
"Hello, Bacchus. You're fatter than when we left Rotterdam, ne?"
He clapped him warmly on the shoulders.
"Lord Jesus Christ, is that truly you?"
"Yes, of course it's me."
"We'd given you up for dead, long ago."
Van Neck reached out and touched Blackthorn to make sure he was not dreaming.
"Lord Jesus, my prayers are answered. Pilot, what happened to you? Where have you come from? It's a miracle. Is it truly you?"
"Yes. Now please put your card in place and let's go inside,"
Blackthorn told him, conscious of his samurai.
"What? Oh, oh, sorry, I..."
Van Neck hastily complied, and tears began to run down his cheeks.
"Oh, Jesus, pilot, I thought the gin devils were playing me tricks again. Come on, but let me announce you, hey?"
He led the way back, weaving a little. Much of his drunkenness evaporated with his joy. Blackthorn followed. Van Neck held the door open for him, then shouted over the raucous singing,
"Lads! Look what Father Christmas has brought us!"
He slammed the door shut after Blackthorn for added effect. Silence was instantaneous. It took a moment for Blackthorn's eyes to adjust to the light. The fetid air was almost choking him. He saw them all gaping at him as though he were a devil wraith. Then the spell broke, and there were shouts of welcome and joy, and everyone was squeezing and punching him on the back, all talking at the same time.
"Pilot, where have you come from?"
"Have a drink."
"Christ, is it possible?"
"Piss in my hat, it's great to see you." "We'd given you up for dead."
"No, we're all right, at least mostly all right." "Get out of the chair, you whore! The pilot's almost to sit in the best sodding chair." "Hey, Grognay! Quick, God curse, quick! God damn my eyes, get out of the way! I want to shake his hand!"
Finally, Vink hollered,
"One at a time, lads. Give him a chance. Give the pilot the chair and a drink, for God's sake. Yes, I thought he was samurai too."
Someone shoved a wooden goblet into Blackthorn's hand. He sat in the rickety chair, and they all raised their cups, and the flood of questions began again. Blackthorn looked around. The room was furnished with benches and a few crude chairs and tables, and illuminated by candles and oil lamps. A huge sake keg stood on the filthy floor. One of the tables was covered with dirty plates, and a haunch of half-roasted meat, crusted with flies. Six bedraggled women cowered on their knees, bowing to him, backed against a wall. His men, all beaming, waited for him to start. Sonk the cook, Johann Vink the bosun's mate and chief gunner, Salomon the mute, Croak the boy, Hinsel the sailmaker, Bacchus van Neck the chief merchant and treasurer, and last, Jan Roper, the other merchant, who sat apart as always, with the same sour smile on his thin, taut face.
"Where's the Captain General?" Blackthorn asked.
"Dead, pilot! He's dead!"
Six voices answered and overrode each other, jumbling the tale until Blackthorn held up his hand.
"Bacchus?"
"He's dead, pilot. He never came out of the pit. Remember he was sick, eh? After they took you away. Well, that night we heard him choking in the darkness. Isn't that right, lads?"
A chorus of yeses, and Van Neck added,
"I was sitting beside him, pilot. He was trying to get the water, but there wasn't any, and he was choking and moaning. I'm not too clear about the time. We were all frightened to death. But eventually, he choked. And then, well, the death rattle. It was bad, pilot."
Jan Roper added,
"It was terrible, yes, but it was God's punishment."
Blackthorn looked from face to face.
"Anybody hit him, to quieten him?"
"No, no, oh no," Van Neck answered. "He just croaked. He was left in the pit with the other one, the Japper. You remember him, the one who tried to drown himself in a bucket of piss? Then the Lord Omi had them bring Spielberger's body out, and they burned it. But that other poor bugger got left below. Lord Omi just gave him a knife, and he slit his own God-cursed belly, and they filled in the pit. You remember him, pilot?"
"Yes. What about Matsiker?"
"Best you tell that, Vink."
"Little rat-face rotted, pilot,"
Vink began, and the others started shouting details and telling the tale until Vink bellowed,
"Bacchus asked me, for Christ's sake! You don't get your turn!"
The voices died down, and Sonk said helpfully,
"You tell it, Johann. Pilot, it was his arm started rotting. He got nicked in the fight. You remember the fight when you got knocked out? Christ Jesus, that seems so long ago. Anyway, his arm festered. I bled him the next day and the next, and it started going black. I told him I'd better lance it, or the whole arm would have to come off. Told him a dozen times, we all did, but he wouldn't. On the fifth day, the wound was stinking. We held him down, and I sliced off most of the rot, but it weren't no good. I knew it wasn't no good, but some of us thought it worth a try. The yellow bastard doctor came a few times, but he couldn't do nothing either. Ratface lasted a day or two, but the rot was too deep, and he raved a lot. We had to tie him up toward the end."
"That's right, pilot,"
Sonk said, scratching comfortably.
"We had to tie him up."
"What happened to his body?" Blackthorn asked.
"They took it up the hill and burned it too. We wanted to give him and the Captain General a proper Christian burial, but they wouldn't let us. They just burned them."
A silence gathered.
"You haven't touched your drink, pilot."
Blackthorn raised it to his lips and tasted. The cup was filthy, and he almost retched. The raw spirit seared his throat. The stench of unbathed bodies and rancid, unwashed clothing almost overpowered him.
"How's the grog, pilot?"
Van Neck asked.
"Fine, fine.
Tell him about it, Bacchus. Go on."
"Hey, I made a still, pilot."
Van Neck was very proud, and the others were beaming too.
"We make it by the barrel now. Rice and fruit and water, and let it ferment. Wait a week or so, and then, with the help of a little magic..."
The rotund man laughed and scratched happily.
"Course it'd be better to keep it a year or so to mellow, but we drink it faster than..."
His words trailed off.
You don't like it?
Oh, sorry. It's fine, fine. Blackthorn saw lice in Van Neck's sparse hair.
Yenroper said challengingly, And you, pilot? You're fine, aren't you? What about you?
Another flood of questions which died as Vink shouted, Give him a chance! Then the leathery-faced man burst out happily.
Christ! When I saw you standing at the door, I thought you was one of the monkeys! Honest! Honest!
Another chorus of agreement, and Van Neck broke in.
That's right. Damn silly kimonos. You look like a woman pilot. Or one of those half-men. God cursed fags, eh? Lot of Jappers are fags, by God. One was off to croak.
There was much shouting and obscene banter. Then Van Neck continued,
You'll want your proper clothes, pilot. Listen, we've got yours here. We came to Edo with Erasmus. They towed her here, and we were allowed to bring our clothes ashore with us. Nothing else. We brought yours. They allowed us to do that, to keep for you. We brought a kit bag. All your sea clothes. Sunk, fetch them, eh? Sure, I'll fetch them. But later, eh, Bacchus? I don't want to miss nothing. All right.
Jan Roper's thin smile was taunting.
Swords and kimonos? Like a real heathen? Perhaps you prefer heathen ways now, pilot.
The clothes are cool. Better than ours, Blackthorn replied uneasily. I'd forgotten I was dressed differently. So much has happened. These were all I had, so I got used to wearing them. I never thought much about it. They're certainly more comfortable.
Are those real swords?
Yes, of course. Why?
We're not allowed weapons. Any weapons.
Jan Roper scowled.
Why do they allow you to have them? Just like any heathen samurai?
Blackthorn laughed shortly.
Huh. You haven't changed, Jan Roper, have you? Still holier than thou. Well, all in good time about my swords. But first, the best news of all. Listen, in a month or so, we'll be on the high seas again.
Jesus God, you mean it, pilot?
Vink said.
Yes.
There was a great roaring cheer and another welter of questions and answers.
I told you we'd get away. I told you God was on our side. Let him talk. Let the pilot talk.
Finally, Blackthorn held up his hand. He motioned at the women, who still knelt motionless, more abject now under his attention.
Who are they?
Sonk laughed.
Them's our doxies, pilot. Our whores, and cheap. Christ Jesus, they hardly cost a button a week. We got a whole house of them next door, and there's plenty more in the village. They rattle like stones.
Croak butted in, and Sonk said,
That's right, pilot. Course, they're squat and bandy, but they've lots of vigour, and no parks. You want one, pilot? We've our own bunks. We're not like the monkeys. We've all our own bunks and rooms.
You try Big Ass Mary, pilot. She's the one for you,
Croak said. Jan Roper's voice overrode them.
The pilot doesn't want one of our harlots. He's got his own. Eh, pilot?
Their faces glowed.
Is that true, pilot? You got women? Hey, tell us, eh? These monkeys are the best that's ever been, eh?
Tell us about your doxies, pilot.
Sonk scratched at his light again.
There's a lot to tell, Blackthorn said, but it should be private. Less is the better, eh? Send the women away, then we can talk privately.
Vink jerked a thumb at them.
Piss off, hi?
The women bowed and mumbled thanks and apologies and fled, closing the door quietly.
First about the ship. It's unbelievable. I want to thank you and congratulate you. All the work. When we get home, I'm going to insist you get triple shares of all the prize money for all that work, and there's going to be a prize beyond.
He saw the men look at each other, embarrassed.
What's the matter?
Van Neck said uncomfortably.
It wasn't us, pilot. It was King Toranaga's men. They did it. Vink showed them how, but we didn't do anything.
What?
We weren't allowed back aboard after the first time. None of us has been aboard except Vink, and he goes once every 10 days or so. We did nothing.
He's the only one, Sonk said.
Johan showed him.
But how did you talk to them, Johan?
There's one of the samurai who talks Portuguese, and we talk in that, enough to understand each other. This samurai, his name's Sato-sama. He was put in charge when we came here. He asked who were officers or seamen among us. We said that would be Hinsel, but he's a gunner mostly. Me and Sonk, who's the worst pissing cook that... Shut your god-cursed mouth, Croak. Shit! You can't cook ashore, let alone afloat, by God!
Please be quiet, you two.
Blackthorn said, Go on, Johan.
Vink continued. Sato-sama asked me what was wrong with the ship, and I told him she had to be careened and scraped and repaired all over. Well, I told him all I knew, and they got on with it. They careened her good and cleaned the bilges, scrubbed them like a prince's shithouse. At least samurai were bosses and other monkeys worked like demons. Hundreds of the buggers. Shit, pilot. You've never seen workers like them.
That's true, Sonk said.
Like demons. I did everything the best I could against the day. Jesus, pilot. You really think we can get away?
Yes, if we're patient. And if we...
If God wills it, pilot. Only then.
Yes, perhaps you're right,
Blackthorn replied, thinking,
What's it matter that Roper's a fanatic? I need him, all of them, and the help of God.
Yes, we need the help of God, he said, and turned back to Vink.
How's her keel?
Clean and sound, pilot. They've done her better than I'd have thought possible. Those bastards are as clever as any carpenters, shipwrights and rope makers in all Holland. Rigging's perfect. Everything.
Sails?
They made a set out of silk, tough as canvas, with a spare set. They took ours down and copied them exact, pilot. Cannon are perfect as possible, all back aboard, and there's powder and shot aplenty. She's ready to sail on the tide, tonight if need be. Of course, she hasn't been to sea, so we won't know about the sails till we're in a gale. But I'll bet my life her seams are as tight as when she was first slipped into the Stelderzee. Better, 'cause the timbers are seasoned now. Thanks be to God.
Vink paused for breath.
When are we off?
A month, about.
They nudged each other, brimming with elation, and loudly toasted the pilot and the ship.
How about enemy shipping? There any hereabouts?
What about prizes, pilot?
Hinsel asked.
Plenty. Beyond your dreams. We're all rich.
Another shout of glee.
It's about time.
Rich, eh? Or buy me a castle.
Oh, God almighty. When I get home.
Rich! Hurrah for the pilot!
Plenty of papists to kill? Good.
Jan Roper said softly.
Very good.
What's the plan, pilot?
Van Neck asked, and they all stopped talking.
I'll come to that in a minute. Do you have guards? Can you move around freely when you want? How often?
Vink said quickly,
We can move anywheres in the village area, perhaps as much as half a league around here. But we're not allowed in Edo, and not...
Not across the bridge,
Sonk broke in happily.
Tell him about the bridge, Johan.
Oh, for the love of God, I was coming to the bridge, Sonk. For God's sake, don't keep interrupting. Pilot, there's a bridge about half a mile southwest. There are a lot of signs on it. That's as far as we're allowed. We're not to go over that. Kinjiru, by God, the samurai say. You understand Kinjiru, pilot?
Blackthorn nodded and said nothing.
Apart from that, we can go where we like, but only up to the barriers. There's barriers all around, about half a league away. Lord God.
Can you believe it? Home soon.
Tell him about the dock, eh? And about the...
The samurai send a doctor once in a while, pilot, and we have to take our clothes off, and he looks at us.
Yes, enough to make a man shit to have a bastard heathen monkey look at you naked like that.
Apart from that, pilot,
They don't bother us, except...
Hey, don't forget the doc gives us some god-rotting filthy powdered char herbs we're supposed to steep in hot water, but we toss them out. When we're sick, good old Johan bleeds us, and we're fit.
Yes, Sonk said.
We throw the char out.
Apart from that, except for... We're lucky here, pilot. Not like at first.
That's right. At first.
Tell him about the inspection, Bacchus.
I was coming to that. For God's sake, be patient. Give a fellow a chance. How can I tell him anything with you all gabbing? Pour me a drink,
Van Neck said thirstily and continued.
Every 10 days, a few samurai come here and we line up outside and he counts us. Then he gives us sacks of rice and cash, copper cash. It's plenty for everything, pilot. We swap rice for meat and stuff, fruit or whatever. There's plenty of everything, and the women do whatever we want. At first we...
But it wasn't like that at first. Tell him about that, Bacchus.
Van Neck sat on the floor.
God give me strength. You feeling sick, poor old lad?
Song asked solicitously.
Best not drink any more, or you'll get the devils back, eh?
He gets the devils, pilot, once a week.
We all do.
Are you going to keep quiet while I tell the pilot?
Oh, me? I haven't said a thing. I'm not stopping you. Here, here's your drink.
Thanks, Zonk. Well, pilot, first they put us in a house to the west of the city. Down near the fields it was.
Damn it! Then you tell the story, Johan.
All right. Christ, pilot, it was terrible. No grub or liquor, and those god-cursed paper houses are like living in a field. A man can't take a piss or pick his nose. Nothing without someone watching, eh? Yes, and the slightest noise would bring the neighbours down on us, and Sammy or I'd be at the stoop. Who wants those bastards around, eh? They'd be shaking their god-cursed swords at us, shouting and hollering, telling us to keep quiet. Well, one night someone knocked over a candle, and the monkeys were all pissed off to hell with us. Jesus God, you should have heard them. They came swarming out of the woodwork with buckets of water, God-cursed mad, hissing and bowing and cursing. It was only one poxy wall that got burned down. Hundreds of them swarmed over the house, like cockroaches. Bastards, you've... Get on with it.
You want to tell it?
Go on, Johan. Don't pay any attention to him. He's only a shitfield cook.
What?
Oh, shut up. For God's sake.
Van Neck hurriedly took up the tale once more.
The next day, pilot, they marched us out of there and put us into another house in the wharf area. That was just as bad. Then some weeks later, Johan stumbled onto this place. He was the only one of us allowed out, because of the ship at that time. They'd collect him daily and bring him back at sunset. He was out fishing. We're only a few hundred yards upstream from the sea. Best you tell it, Johan.
Blackthorn felt an itch on his bare leg, and he rubbed it without thinking. The irritation got worse. Then he saw the mottled lump of a flea bite, as Vink continued proudly.
It's like Bacchus said, pilot. I asked Sato-sama if we could move, and he said, yes, why not? They'd usually let me fish from one of their little skiffs to pass the time. It was my nose that led me here, pilot. The old nose led me. Blood.
Blackthorn said,
a slaughterhouse. A slaughterhouse and tanning. That's...
He stopped and blanched.
What's up? What is it?
This is an Etta village. Jesus Christ, these people are Etta? What's wrong with Ettas?
Van Neck asked.
Of course they're Ettas.
Blackthorn waved at the mosquitoes that infested the air, his skin crawling.
Damn bugs. They're rotten, aren't they? There's a tannery here, isn't there?
Yes, a few streets up. Why?
Nothing. I didn't recognize the smell, that's all.
What about Etta's?
I didn't realize, stupid of me.
If I'd seen one of the men, I'd have known from their short hairstyle. With the women, you'd never know.
Sorry,
Go on with the story, Vink.
Well, then they said...
Jan Roper interrupted. Wait a minute, Vink. What's wrong, pilot? What about Etters?
It's just that Japanese think of them as different. They're the executioners and work the hides and handle corpses.
He felt their eyes, Jan Roper's particularly.
Etta work hides, he said, trying to keep his voice careless, and kill all the old horses and oxen and handle dead bodies. But what's wrong with that, pilot? You've buried a dozen yourself, put them in shrouds, washed them. We all have, eh? We butcher our own meat, always have. Insel here's been hangman. What's wrong with all that?
Nothing, Blackthorne said, knowing it to be true, yet feeling befouled even so. Vink snorted.
Ha! Etters are the best heathen we've seen here. More like us than the other bastards. We're God-cursed lucky to be here, pilot. Fresh meat's no problem, or tallow. They give us no trouble. That's right, if you've lived with Etters, pilot. Jesus Christ! The pilot's had to live with the other bastards all the time. He doesn't know any better. How about fetching big-ass Mary Sonk?
Or Twinkle Bum?
Shit, not her, not that old whore. The pilot'll want a special. Let's ask Mama-san.
I bet he's starving for real grub. Hey, Sonk, cut him a slice of meat.
And some old grog. Three cheers for the pilot.
In the happy uproar, Van Neck clapped Blackthorne on the shoulders.
You're home, old friend.
Now you're back, our prayers are answered, and all's well in the world. You're home, old friend. Listen, take my bunk. I insist.
Cheerily Blackthorne waved a last time. There was an answering shout from the darkness, the far side of the little bridge. Then he turned away. His forced heartiness evaporated, and he walked around the corner, the samurai guard of 10 men surrounding him. On the way back to the castle, his mind was locked in confusion.
Nothing was wrong with Etta, and everything was wrong with Etta. Those are my crew there, my own people, and these are heathen and foreign and enemy.
Streets and alleys and bridges passed in a blur. Then he noticed that his own hand was inside his kimono, and he was scratching, and he stopped in his tracks.
Those goddamn filthy!
He undid his sash and ripped off his sopping kimono, and as though it were defiled, hurled it in a ditch.
Dojo, nan desu ka, Anjin-san?
One of the samurai asked.
Nani mo?
Nothing, by God. Blackthorne walked on, carrying his swords.
Ah, Etta, wakarimasu, gomen nasai.
The samurai chattered among themselves, but he paid them no attention.
That's better,
he was thinking with utter relief, not noticing that he was almost naked, only that his skin had stopped crawling now that the flea-infested kimono was off.
Jesus God, I'd love a bath right now.
He had told the crew about his adventures, but not that he was samurai in Hatamoto, or that he was one of Toranaga's protégés, or about Hujiko, or Mariko. And he had not told them that they were going to land in force at Nagasaki and take the black ship by storm, or that he would be at the head of the samurai.
That can come later, he thought wearily,
and all the rest.
Could I ever tell them about Mariko-san?
His wooden clogs clattered on the wooden slats of First Bridge. Samurai sentries, also half-naked, lolled until they saw him. Then they bowed politely as he passed, watching him intently. Because this was the incredible barbarian who was astonishingly favoured by Lord Toranaga, to whom Toranaga had, unbelievably, granted the never given before to a barbarian honour of Hatamoto and samurai. At the main south gate of the castle, another guide waited for him. He was escorted to his quarters within the inner ring. He had been allocated a room in one of the fortified though attractive guest houses, but he politely refused to go back there at once.
First bath, please, he told the samurai. Ah, I understand. That's very considerate of you. The bathhouse is this way, Anjin-san. Yes, it's a hot night, ne? And I hear you've been down to the filthy ones. The other guests in the house will appreciate your thoughtfulness.
I thank you on their behalf.
Blackthorn did not understand all the words, but he gathered the meaning. Filthy ones. That describes my people and me. Us, not them, poor people.
Good evening, Anjin son,
the chief bath attendant said. He was a vast middle-aged man with immense belly and biceps. A maid had just awakened him to announce another late customer was arriving. He clapped his hands. Both maids arrived. Blackthorn followed them into the scrubbing room, and they cleansed him and shampooed him, and he made them do it a second time. Then he walked through to the sunken bath, stepped into the piping hot water, and fought the heat, then gave himself to its mind-consuming embrace. In time, strong hands helped him out and molded fragrant oil into his skin and untwisted his muscles and his neck, then led him to a resting room and gave him a laundered sun-fresh cotton kimono. With a long, drawn-out sigh of pleasure, he lay down.
Dosu gomen nasai. Cha, Anjin-san.
Hai, domo.
The cha arrived. He told the maid he would stay here tonight and not trouble to go to his own quarters. Then, alone and at peace, he sipped the cha, feeling it purify him.
Filthy-looking char herbs, he thought disgustedly.
Be patient. Don't let it disturb your harmony, he said aloud. They're just poor ignorant fools who don't know any better. You were the same once. Never mind. Now you can show them, eh?
He put them out of his mind and reached for his dictionary. But tonight, for the first night since he had possessed the book, he laid it carefully aside and blew out the candle.
I'm too tired, he told himself. But not too tired to answer a simple question, his mind said. Are they really ignorant fools, or is it you who are fooling yourself?
I'll answer that later, when it's time. Now the answer's unimportant. Now I only know I don't want them near me.
He turned over and put that problem into a compartment and went to sleep. He awoke refreshed. A clean kimono and loincloth and tabi were laid out. The scabbards of his swords had been polished. He dressed quickly. Outside the house, samurai were waiting. They got off their haunches and bowed.
We're your guard today, Anjin-san.
Thank you. Go ship now.
Yes. Here's your pass.
Good.
Thank you.
May I ask your name, please?
Musashi Mitsutoki.
Thank you, Musashi-san. Go now.
They went down to the wharves. Erasmus was moored tightly in 3 fathoms over a sanding bottom. The bilges were sweet. He dived over the side and swam under the keel. Seaweed was minimal, and there were only a few barnacles. The rudder was sound. In the magazine, which was dry and spotless, he found a flint and struck a spark to a tiny test mound of gunpowder. It burned instantly, in perfect condition. Aloft at the foremost peak, he looked for telltale cracks. None there, or on the climb up, or around any of the spars that he could see. Many of the ropes and halyards and shrouds were joined incorrectly, but that would only take half a watch to change. Once more on the quarterdeck, he allowed himself a great smile.
You're sound as a... as a what?
He could not think of a sufficiently great what, so he just laughed and went below again. In his cabin, he felt alien, and very alone. His swords were on the bunk. He touched them, then slid oil cellar out of its scabbard. The workmanship was marvellous, and the edge perfect. Looking at the sword gave him pleasure, for it was truly a work of art.
But a deadly one, he thought as always, twisting it in the light. How many deaths have you caused in your life of 200 years? How many more before you die yourself? Do some swords have a life of their own, as Mariko says?
Mariko. What about her?
Then he caught sight of his sea chest reflected in the steel, and this took him out of his sudden melancholy. He sheathed oil cellar, careful to avoid fingering the blade, for custom said that even a single touch might mar such perfection. As he leaned against the bunk, his eyes went to his empty sea chest.
What about rutters?
and navigation instruments? He asked his image in the copper sea lamp that had been scrupulously polished like everything else. He saw himself answer.
You buy them at Nagasaki, along with your crew, and you snatch Rodriguez. Yes, you snatch him before the attack, eh?
He watched his smile grow.
You're very sure Taranaga will let you go, aren't you?
Yes, he answered with complete confidence.
If he goes to Osaka or not, I'll get what I want. And I'll get Mariko, too.
Satisfied, he stuck his swords in his sash and walked up on deck and waited until the doors were resealed. When he got back to the castle, it was not yet noon, so he went to his own quarters to eat. He had rice and two helpings of fish that had been broiled over charcoal with soya by his own cook, as he had taught the man. A small flask of sake, then char.
Anshin-san?
Hai?
The shoji opened. Fujiko smiled shyly and bowed. Chapter 49.
I'd forgotten about you, he said in English. I was afraid you were dead.
Dozo gozaimashita, Anjin-san. Nandesuka?
Nani mo, Fujiko-san, he told her, ashamed of himself. Gomen nasai. Hai, gomen nasai. Masware odoroita, honto ni mata ete ureshi.
Please excuse me. A surprise, ne? Good to see you. Please sit down.
Tomo arigato gozaimashita,
she said, and told him in her thin, high voice how pleased she was to see him, how much his Japanese had improved, how well he looked, and how most very glad she was to be here. He watched her kneel awkwardly on the cushion opposite.
Legs.
He sought the word burns, but couldn't remember it. So he said instead,
legs, fire, hurt? Bad?
No, so sorry, but it still hurts a little to sit,
Fujiko said, concentrating, watching his lips.
Legs hurt. So sorry.
Please show me.
So sorry, please, Anjin-san. I don't wish to trouble you. You have other problems. I'm...
Don't understand. Too fast. Sorry.
Ah, sorry. Legs all right. No trouble,
she pleaded.
Trouble? You are consort, ne? No shame. Show now.
Obediently, she got up. Clearly, she was uncomfortable, but once she was upright, she began to untie the strings of her obi.
Please call maid, he ordered.
She obeyed. At once, the shoji slid open, and a woman he did not recognize rushed to assist her. First, the stiff obi was unwound. The maid put Hujiko's sheathed dagger and obi to one side.
What's your name?
He asked the maid brusquely, as a samurai should.
Oh, please excuse me, sire. So very sorry. My name is Hanaichi.
He grunted an acknowledgement.
Miss First Blossom. There's a fine name.
All maids, by custom, were called Miss Brush, or Crane, or Fish, or Second Broom, or Fourth Moon, or Star, or Tree, or Branch, and so on. Hanaichi was middle-aged and very concerned.
I'll bet she's a family retainer, he told himself. Perhaps a vassal of Hujiko's late husband.
Husband. I'd forgotten about him as well, and the child who was murdered, as the husband was murdered by fiend Toranaga, who's not a fiend but a daimyo, and a good, perhaps great, leader.
Yes. Probably the husband deserved his fate, if the real truth were known, eh? But not the child, he thought. There's no excuse for that.
Fujiko allowed her green-patterned outer kimono to fall aside loosely. Her fingers trembled as she untied the thin silken sash of the yellow underkimono and let that fall aside also. Her skin was light, and the part of her breast he could see within the folds of silk showed that they were flat and small. Anaichi knelt and untied the strings of the underskirt that reached from her waist to the floor to enable her mistress to step out of it.
Iye,
he ordered. He walked over and lifted the hem. The burns began at the backs of her calves.
Gomen nasai,
he said. She stood motionless. A tear of sweat trickled down her cheek, spoiling her makeup. He pulled the skirt higher. The skin was burned all up the backs of her legs, but it seemed to be healing perfectly. Scar tissue had formed already, and there was no infection, and no suppurations, only a little clean blood where the new scar tissue had broken at the backs of her knees as she had knelt. He moved her kimonos aside and loosed the underskirt waistband. The burn stopped at the top of her legs, bypassed her rump where the beam had pinned her down and protected her, then began again in the small of her back. A swathe of burn, half a handspan, girdled her waist. Scar tissue was already settling into permanent crinkles. Unsightly, but healing perfectly.
Doctor, very good. Best I ever see.
He let her kimonos fall back.
Best, Hujiko-san. The scars. What does it matter, ne? Nothing. I see many fire hurts, understand? Once see, then sure good or not good. Doctor, very good. Buddha watch, Hujiko-san.
He put his hands on her shoulders and looked into her eyes.
No worry now. Shigata ga nai, ne? You understand?
Her tears spilled.
Please excuse me, Anjin-san. I'm so embarrassed. Please excuse my stupidity for being there, caught there like a half-witted Eta. I should have been with you, guarding you, not stuck with servants in the house. There's nothing for me in the house, nothing, no reason to be in a house.
He let her talk on, though he understood almost nothing of what she said, holding her compassionately.
I've got to find out what the doctor used, he thought excitedly. That's the quickest and the best healing I've ever seen. Every master of every one of Her Majesty's ships should know that secret. Yes, and truly, every captain of every ship in Europe. Wait a moment. Wouldn't every master pay golden guineas for that secret? You could make a fortune. Yes. But not that way, he told himself. Never that. Never out of a sailor's agony. She's lucky, though, that it was only the backs of her legs and her back and not her face.
He looked down at her face. It was still as square and flat as ever, her teeth just as sharp and ferret-like, but the warmth that flowed from her eyes compensated for the ugliness. He gave her another hug.
Now, no weep. Order.
He sent the maid for fresh char and sake, and many cushions, and helped her recline on them, as much as at first it embarrassed her to obey.
How can I ever thank you?
She said.
No thanks. Give back.
Blackthorn thought a moment, but he couldn't remember the Japanese words for favor, or remember, so he pulled out the dictionary and looked them up.
Favor. Onegai. Remember. Omoidas. Hai, mondoso onegai. Omoidasuka?
Give back favor. Remember? He held up his fists mimicking pistols and pointing them.
Omi-san, remember?
Oh, of course,
she cried out. Then, in wonder, she asked to look at the book. She had never seen Roman writing before, and the column of Japanese words into Latin and into Portuguese and vice versa were meaningless to her, but she quickly grasped its purpose.
It's a book of all our... So sorry. Word book, ne?
Hi.
Bonbon?
She asked. He showed her how to find the word in Latin and in Portuguese.
Bonbon. Duty.
Then added in Japanese.
I understand duty. Samurai duty, ne?
Hi.
She clapped her hands as if she had been shown a magic toy.
But it is magic, isn't it?
He told himself.
A gift from God. This unlocks her mind and Toranaga's mind, and soon I'll speak perfectly.
She gave him other words, and he told her English or Latin or Portuguese, always understanding the words she chose and always finding them. The dictionary never failed. He looked up a word.
Majutsu desu, ne?
It's magic, isn't it?
Yes, Anjin-san. The book's magic.
She sipped her cha.
Now I can talk to you. Really talk to you.
Little. Only slow, understand.
Yes, Please be patient with me. Please excuse me.
The huge donjon bell sounded the hour of the goat, and the temples in Edo echoed the time change.
I go now. Go, Lord Torunaga.
He put the book into his sleeve.
I'll wait here, please, if I may.
Where stay?
She pointed.
Oh, there. My room's next door. Please excuse my abruptness.
Slowly. Talk slowly. Talk simply.
She repeated it slowly with more apologies.
Good, he said. Good. I'll see you later.
She began to get up, but he shook his head and went into the courtyard. The day was overcast now, the air suffocating. Guards awaited him. Soon he was in the donjon forecourt. Mariko was there, more slender than ever, more ethereal, her face alabaster under her rust-gold parasol. She wore somber brown, edged with green.
Ohayo, Anjin-san. Ikaga desu ka?
She asked, bowing formally. He told her that he was fine, happily keeping up their custom of talking in Japanese for as long as he could, turning to Portuguese only when he was tired or when they wished to be more secretive.
Thou, he said cautiously, as they walked up the stairs of the donjon.
Thou,
Mariko echoed, and went immediately into Portuguese with the same gravity as last night.
So sorry. Please, no Latin today, Anjin-san. Today Latin cannot sit well. Latin cannot serve the purpose it was made for. Nay?
When can I talk to you?
That's very difficult. So sorry. I have duties.
There's nothing wrong, is there?
Oh, no, she replied. Please excuse me. What could be wrong? Nothing's wrong.
They climbed another flight in silence. On the next level, their passes were checked, as always, guards leading and following them. Rain began heavily, and this eased the humidity.
It'll rain for hours, he said.
Yes, but without the rains, there's no rice. Soon the rains will stop altogether. In 2 or 3 weeks. Then it will be hot and humid until the autumn.
She looked out of the windows at the enveloping cloudburst.
You'll enjoy the autumn, Anjin-san.
Yes.
He was watching Erasmus, far distant, down beside the wharf. Then the rains obscured his ship, and he climbed a little way.
After we've talked with Lord Torunaga, we'll have to wait till this has passed. Perhaps there'd be somewhere here we could talk.
That might be difficult,
she said vaguely, and he found this odd. She was usually decisive and implemented his polite suggestions as the orders they would normally be considered.
Please excuse me, Anjin-san, but things are difficult for me at the moment, and there are many things I have to do.
She stopped momentarily and shifted her parasol to her other hand, holding the hem of her skirt.
How was your evening? How were your friends? Your crew?
Fine. Everything was fine, he said.
But not fine, she asked.
Fine, but very strange.
He looked back at her.
You notice everything, don't you?
No, Anjin-san. But you didn't mention them, and you've been thinking about them greatly this last week or so. I'm no magician. So sorry.
After a pause, he said,
You're sure you're all right? There's no problem with Buntaro-san, is there?
He'd never discussed Buntaro with her, or mentioned his name since Yokose. By agreement, that spectre was never conjured up by either of them since the first moment.
This is my only request, Anjin-san,
she had whispered the first night.
Whatever happens during our journey to Mishima, or, Madonna willing, to Edo, this has nothing to do with anything. But us, ne? Nothing is to be mentioned between us about what really is. Ne? Nothing. Please?
I agree. I swear it.
And I do likewise. Finally, our journey ends at Edo's first bridge.
No.
There must be an ending, my darling. At first bridge, our journey ends. Please. Or I will die with agony over fear for you and the danger I have put you in.
Yesterday morning, he had stood at the threshold of First Bridge, a sudden weight on his spirit, in spite of his elation over Erasmus.
"We should cross the bridge now, Anjin-san,"
she had said. "Yes.